There's a question, too, I've always had about the book. Where's Mildred's name come? I kept saying, is she referring to Mildred Pierce?
No, I don't know. I don't quite know where that came from. But the thing about all the names of the books, there's unconscious things going on here. Montag, of course, is the maker of paper, the stationery, huh? And Montag Papers. And I used to buy that Montag paper in a bookstore when I was a kid, huh? But I never thought of it. And then Faber is the maker of pencils. and the woman who's burned in the middle sequence of the novel is Sherlock Holmes' housekeeper. Huh? So her name derives from Sherlock Holmes. So, but I didn't know any of this when I wrote the book.
Speaking about that scene, because I didn't realize her name was from Holmes, but you use self-immolation. I mean, it's a terrifying thing. This woman has the matches in her hand. Beatty yeah. kind of knows she might have a match in her hand. Yeah. Montag doesn't, right? And this is because we think of the self-immolation that we saw during the Vietnam War of the monks in Vietnam.
Yes.
And you wrote this in 49-50, and this is self-immolation, someone who would die for a book.
That's right. And there's so many things in my play now that came to me later that I wish I'd put in the book in much more detail. The lady who burns herself has a dialogue with all of her books on the stage, and she talks to them, and they talk back. She calls out to them, and they answer. Well, that's me in the library when I was a kid with all these ghosts calling out to them, and they answer. It's a very personal thing. I'm tempted to go back and put that in the book, too, and have the books talk to her, you know, because it makes them all the more important.
There's this hound, this fierce mechanical hound, is such an extraordinary creation. And it's so prescient that you created this. I mean, this is the mechanical beast that we're all afraid of. This is a biblical mechanical beast.
And so, that's right.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you came up with this almost spider-like hound?
Well, here we go again with unconscious background discoveries. When I was 10 years old, there used to be a series on sponsored by G. Washington's Coffee of Sherlock Holmes. It was on radio every Monday night, I believe, at 9 o'clock. Well, one night when I was 10, that program was on, and my mother and father went two blocks away to a band concert in the park. The Hound of the Baskervilles came on, huh? And the sound of that hound wailing in the night scared the hell out of me. And I ran out of the house and ran to the park to find my parents, and because I couldn't be in the house with that hound. So the hound in Fahrenheit 451 is the Hound of the Baskervilles that scared me as a child. And I put extra legs on it, and there it is.
And you also deal with its programming, which was an idea which most Americans and most people, even in the science, didn't know much. You are programming a beast. I mean, we take this as common knowledge today. Yeah. But in 49, I mean, there was only one computer in the United States, or
That's
two.
Right.
And how did you sense that this was a robot? This is a robotic device that's programmed.
Well, there's so much in every novel that it can never be explained. You live a life of secrecy, and if you're a good writer, you surprise everything out in the open. It's like going hunting and firing off a gun, and a bush that's in front of you doesn't look like it's inhabited, and suddenly all kinds of birds fly out in the open. And that's what writing is. You don't want to know what you're doing, huh? You must never know what you're doing. And then the surprise is the good stuff. So all the scientific speculation, the machineries that I invented, they were all things that flew out of the bushes when I fired off a gun. Huh? And then later, as with the hound, I've just told you, I haven't thought of that much in recent years, but the hound is Sherlock Holmes' friend. Yeah.
your description of how things fly out, you don't see them, and all of a sudden they do appear, is a beautiful description of the writing process.
Yeah.
And we read it now because we see ATMs in your book. We see a large screen projection television. I mean, all these things that you saw. These are, again, were things that just came out of your imagination.
Well, when I was 11 or 12 years old in the Chicago Tribune, I lived in Waukegan, north of Chicago, about 30 miles. In the daily paper, they printed a radio script with missing parts. So you would tune in the radio show, and they'd read every other line, and you'd read every other line in your living room. So you could be part of a radio play. And that was the genesis of the relationship of Mildred to her TV set in the TV room in her house. But that began when I was about 11 years old. And I wanted to be a radio actor. I loved everything to do with the radio. I listened to it. I belonged to the Tarzan Club, the Little Orphan Annie Club. I got a secret decoder ring, you know, and the Buck Rogers Club. And I was enamored of radio. Well, when I lived out in Tucson, Arizona, there was a radio station there, and I sang the lead in a Christmas show at junior high school by accident. The teacher made me get up and try out. I didn't want to do it, and I got the lead, okay? So that fixed me forever on the stage. When I heard that applause, boy, that was the greatest. I said to my friends, I'm going to go in town and get a job as a radio actor. They said, do you know anyone there? No, I don't. Does your father know any? No. Well, how are you going to get a job? I said, I'll hang around the station and be agreeable. So I went and hung around the station, and 2 weeks later I got the job of reading the comic strips to the kiddies every Saturday night and playing parts, huh? So all these things begin to feed into the future and TV and the screens, what have you, but it's part of my madness about acting. Yeah.
It's just one other thing. There's the Beetle cars. You have these wonderful Beetle cars that appear that the fire people ride around in, and they have this emblem. I mean, this is almost like a swastika.
That's right, yeah.
Was that the intent?
It could be. See, many nights in my life, maybe 4 or 5 nights a year when I can't sleep, I get up at 3 in the morning, go down in the living room, pick one of my books off the shelf and open it anywhere. And I read and I say, I'll be damned, you know, I wrote that. And sometimes I cry because it was such a surprise. Nothing has ever been intellectualized. And I've never searched for words. I've never questioned. I just wrote it, and very few corrections. Everything pours out, yeah? And so I've learned to respect that. But still, it's even more of a surprise years later to go back and read that and say, I'll be damned, I did that. I'm that guy that wrote that book. It was illustrated for me. I worked for John Huston in Dublin back in 1953, writing the screenplay of Moby Dick, but he was a stickler for intellectualizing things, which ruined creativity, you know? He got in his own way. There was a wonderful line in an old Phil Silvers musical on Broadway, Top Banana, when the girl's trying out for a role, and he finally said, honey, get out of your way and let it happen, huh? Well, that's the story of my life. In the middle of writing the script of Moby Dick, we had a certain problem on a certain day with a certain line, a certain scene, and John Huston kept working at it, and he had Peter Virgil there with him and with me. We're trying to solve this sentence or that line or that certain word, and I finally said, for God's sake, let's all go to bed. I'm going back to Dublin. I'm going to put a pad and pencil by my bed, and you, John, put a pad and pencil by your bed, and Peter, you put one by your bed, and during the night, one of us will wake up and have the answer. Now, I'm leaving, so I left. They poo-pooed me, you know. Oh, it won't work that way. The next morning, at 6 o'clock in the morning, John Huston called me and said, "Ray, I've got the answer." I said, "You son of a bitch. You never question me again about these things, huh? The subconscious works in mysterious ways. I don't know. I'm not going to be mystical about it, but I know it works, huh? So next time, let's not sit around and intellectualize and try to find a word, huh? Because it's not going to come, huh?"
There's a wonderful answer. There's a wonderful story that you've told. When you came to Los Angeles and you got you watched the picture business, you didn't have enough money to go to college. You went to the library instead.
That's right.
And you stayed in the library until you were 28, and then you graduated yourself.
That's
right.
Can
you tell the people who have listened to the book about your self-education?
Yeah, well, when I got out of high school, I had no money. My father was on relief. We were getting money from the government, my family, because my father had been out of work for years. And I got a job selling newspapers on a street corner. And I put my name in to the local university college, and I had all my credits there, and I was going to start being educated in drama and writing. And then I thought to myself, why am I doing this? And the answer was girls, of course, yeah? And I thought to myself, well, that's very nice, but what has that got to do with writing? Nothing, huh? And if you're not careful, you're going to ruin your life. So I made the big decision. I stayed on the street corner. I made $10 a week, and I went to the library and educated myself. I spent 2 or 3 days a week in the library for the next 10 years, and graduated from the library when I was 28. Well, the head of a university up north in California heard about this a couple of years ago, and during my lecture, he came on the stage and handed me my diploma, graduating me from the library. Isn't that beautiful? Just great. Yeah.
It is. Though the libraries, you met your wife in the library. You met Christopher Isherwood. I mean, a bookstore. I mean, bookstores and libraries are the
right.
Same thing. I mean, there's a wonderful story that you tell about, well, you met your wife in a bookstore. I don't know where the bookstore was, Chatterton's or something, and you met Christopher Isherwood, and that had enormous influence.
Yeah, those two.
Can you tell those stories?
Yeah, all the women in my life have been librarians, English teachers, or booksellers, huh? And my wife was a combination of those. I went in Fowler Brothers Bookstore, downtown L.A., in April of 1946, looking for a book, Rue Morgue Number 1, in which I had my first anthologized short story. So this clerk who waited on me, Marguerite McClure, was curious about me not only because I was a writer looking for a book, but she suspected I was the book thief who had been stealing books from Fowler Brothers Bookstore for the last few months. And her boss, Mr. Fowler, told her to keep an eye on me because I looked terribly suspicious. I had a briefcase that I kept laying about on various books, and they thought maybe I had a trap door in there picking books up. So when my wife discovered I was a writer, we began to talk, and a couple of days later I took her out for coffee, and then I took her out to lunch, I took her out to dinner, and then I started chasing her all over town. And we got married, and we lived in Venice, California, in a little $30-a-month apartment, and she took a vow of poverty to marry me because she had a decent allowance every week, $50 to $100, a lot of money 55 years ago. But she gave that up. And when we got married, we had $8 in the bank. And I put $5 in an envelope and handed it to the minister who did our ceremony. And he said, "What's this?" I said, "That's your fee for today." And he said, "Well, you're a writer, aren't you?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Then you're going to need this." And he gave me the envelope back, and I took it. And years later, I sent him a decent check. But we were so poor, we couldn't afford a telephone the first year. And we lived in this little tiny apartment near the corner of South Venice Boulevard and Ocean Road there. And there was a gas station across the street with an outdoor telephone booth. And when that phone would ring, I had the window open in our apartment. I'd run out of the apartment, run across the street, answer the phone as if it were my private phone line, huh? And it would be the president of CBS calling or the head of a studio, not realizing that I didn't have a telephone. So that went on for a year. That's how poor we were. But we were rich in love, huh? And when I look back, I was thinking about those years this morning, that how lucky I was to be that much in love. And as poor as we were, it didn't matter because love is so incredible in those years. And gradually, our income went up. And not once in all those years, God bless her, did my wife ever mention money. Huh? We never had any trouble because we didn't have any. So what was there to talk about?
There's another bookstore, since libraries, we're talking about Fahrenheit 451. In another bookstore, your career did change because you bumped into Christopher Isherwood. And can you tell people, because this is not an often repeated story. It's a wonderful story.
Well, I have a very scary story to tell, because if it hadn't happened, my life might have been different. These are very strange things. I went into the bookstore in Santa Monica in the spring of 1950, and the Martian Chronicles had just been published with no reviews, little obituary reviews in the back of magazines somewhere, but nothing. And in the bookstore, I saw Christopher Isherwood, and I recognized him. I didn't know him, and I went up and introduced myself, and I grabbed a copy of the Martian Chronicles off the bookshelf there, and I signed it and gave it to him. Well, his face fell. I could just see what he was thinking. Oh, my God, one more book to read, you know, and from some crazy author. So he left the store, but 3 days later, I got a phone call, and it was Christopher Isherwood. And he said, "Mr. Bradbury," I said, "Yes." He says, "Do you know what you've done?" I said, "No, what have I done?" He said, "You've written a remarkable book. And I've just been made book editor of Tomorrow Magazine, and it's the first book I'm going to review, and I'm going to do a 3-page review of it." So he wrote this long essay about this incredible book, and it changed my life. He introduced me to Gerald Hurd, the English philosopher, and to Aldous Huxley, and I had tea with Aldous Huxley one day, my hero. I'd read everything of his. And I hate tea, of course, and you got to pretend to love it if you're going to have tea with Aldous Huxley. But Mr. Huxley leaned forward, and in his very quiet voice, he said, "Do you know what you are?" I said, "No, what am I, Mr. Huxley?" He said, "You are a poet. You are a poet." So that was the first I ever knew that, huh? And I didn't really think about it until years later when I began to write poetry full-time when I was in my 40s. But that encounter with Huxley and with Mr. Hurd and with Isherwood convinced me that I was bright, finally. I'd never thought of that. All those years through high school and after that, no one had ever told me I was bright. Most of the time they told me I was dumb or I was a wimp or I was a nerd. The bullies got to me. So I learned... I never thought of looking in the mirror and saying, "Gee, that's a pretty bright guy." I just did my work, and now my peers are telling me that I'm okay. So I began to relax more and experiment more. Yeah.
And what peers? What peers?
Yes, yeah.
The best.